Welcome to Cobblestones. Today we follow the path eclectic to a little basement in Prince George's County, Maryland, filled with a few ping pong ball eyes, a little felt, and some big ideas that led to a workshop filled with pigs, birds, frogs, and what's that? As we consider the legacy of Jim Henson.
Excuse me? Legacy? What do you mean legacy?
You know, how modern puppeteers carry on the tradition, pay their respects to those that have come before them.
Nope. Still not getting it. Legacy. Like, I see your legs under the table. See legs?
No, I...
What does Jim Henson have to do with legs anyway? He was a dancer, not a huffer.
Mmm, what you getting so upset about?
Jim Henson's legs.
I see. I, too, am a leg man, and found it disappointing how rarely we got to see Piggy's gams.
Or Kermit's frog legs.
No, 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 no. Not legs. Legacy. What is Jim Henson's legacy?
Oh, a legacy.
An homage.
An ode.
Oh, an ode. A dove. A dove dove. A dove dove at a fair. A dove dove at the fair served at the fair. The fair at the fair was only fair. Still, the dove dove. The dove dove at the fair served at the fair, even though the fair charged wasn't fair at all.
Hold it!
What?
This poem is missing something. Something crucial. Something important. Something every good puppet show needs.
What's that?
Good writing!
Ah!
What are you doing?
Writing. You said we need good writing, so I'm writing.
You're not writing. You are typing. Writing requires a pencil. Besides, no one writes anymore. No one dials. No one rolls down a window. And if you ever listen to the radio, you'd know they certainly don't employ writers. They use speakers.
You mean the things attached to my stereo?
Don't be so literal. You can't write on a keyboard. There's not enough room. Look, you can't write a story on a keyboard unless you are... No. Typecasting.
Typecasting? I thought he was writing, not fishing.
I am writing, not fishing.
Then why are you throwing away so many good lines?
I don't believe in typecasting. Typecasting is as ridiculous as trying to put a puppet show on the radio.
So you don't use worms?
Ah!
Listen, I am writing a story so we can pay tribute to Jim Henson.
Oh, why didn't you say so?
He sure gets grumpy.
Are you done yet?
Cobblestones. They come in all shapes and sizes, all hues and textures. Some are round, gray, and dull. Others are sharp, smooth, and brilliant. This one may be blue, and just a little bit fuzzy. Muppeteer Dave Goles had no background in theater or puppetry, but he saw Sesame Street one day and became enthralled. This one-time industrial designer for Hewlett-Packard shares the story of his early days as a performer with Jim Henson.
You know, it's funny because we're the only performers who are both performer and audience at the same time. While we're performing, we're watching monitors, we're helping to compose the shots, we're placing our own eye lines, you know, we're doing everything that a normal performer cannot do. And the whole process is just so engaging in that way.
It's kind of funny, you know, you talk to people and tell them, you're about to interview someone at the White House, and they're like, okay, great. The two biggest reactions I've had so far in my NPR career have been, I'm doing a report on the Chocolate Lovers Festival. Everyone's very excited about that. And you. And that's just because everyone wanted samples.
Yeah. That's funny. Oh, the two highlights, yes. Well, it is weird. You know, we go in and do appearances when we're on publicity tours and so forth, and we'll walk into a television station and... you know, we're kind of ignored, and we do the characters, and then we can't get out, you know, because people are so charmed. They just love them so much. And even if they weren't fans before, once they see them in action, they're rabid about it.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, those characters are alive, and they resonate so deeply with each of us. All of us who have been geeks, like myself, think of one of your main characters, Gonzo, and it's like, oh my God, you're my hero.
Well, you know, it's funny. In his case, I don't actually quite know who he is, you know, and yet he's the easiest one of all to ad lib with and to play around with. But they, you know, the reason for that is that they're alive is that they come directly from a single performer, and so they're really a form of psychodrama. They're an aspect of a performer's personality, and usually just one or two aspects, not the whole personality. And you have infinite material to draw upon when you do that.
Well, I guess that'll bring us to the formal part of the interview, because that's sort of close to my third question, which is, when I was watching The Muppet Show always seemed pretty egoless to me. You know, every character got its moment to shine. Now, was that really true? And if so, how long did it take each of the performers to earn Jim's trust to be given that chance to carry a scene or a moment?
Well, that's a great question. Jim was a risk taker, and he did trust people. He hired people that he felt some kinship with. And he was capable of appreciating many, many different kinds of people. You know, we sometimes looked at the people around us, the other people who worked with Jim, and didn't understand them. We didn't understand each other. But Jim saw something that he really appreciated in each one of us. And over time, as we worked together, we began to appreciate those things in each other, too. It was almost as though he was building a Noah's Ark, and he brought all these natural enemies aboard. And by sailing together, they ended up appreciating each other, tolerating and more than tolerating, appreciating and loving.
So was the genius behind the Muppets more about competition between the actors and the writers, or about working together and camaraderie?
Wow, another great question. Those are both true. Those situations are both true, and I think it comes from the fact that Jim himself was unique. He was a brilliant creator, and he was also a true collaborator. He sort of ran a creative salon in which everybody who was in the room had permission to contribute, and Jim appreciated people's contributions. Anyone, you know, a stagehand, a camera operator, anybody could come to Jim with an idea for a scene we were shooting. And if it seemed right to Jim, he would use it. And so, you know, our crews generally all felt like a part of what we were doing.
So how often did you actually hear, no, or we can't do that, that's impossible?
Well, Jim certainly was the arbiter. Everything was run through his creative vision, you know. And so he made the judgments and the choices. But he did it in such a gentle way that we all had fun with it. You know, I mean, we were very free to play. And to refer back to your earlier question about competition between performers, I think what I recall was that the performers were quite competitive with each other, but I don't recall being competitive with the writers. You know, we were always happy to add an ad lib if we could, and Jim would usually make that decision. But, you know, this is a kind of a business where it's not a matter of being able to cheat. There's a truth involved. You know, it's very clear when something works. If it's funny or poignant, you know it. Everybody knows it. You know what I mean? So it's just, it was just the ideal creative environment to work in. The more time goes by, the more I realize how precious it was.
And what really tickled Jim? What made him laugh? What made him lose it?
Being tired. That's an easy one. Jim Henson worked very hard. His whole life was integrated. His family and his friends and his employees were all intermingled. You know, I mean, he didn't have a huge life outside of the Muppets. If he had dinner with somebody, it would usually be with a colleague and or his family. You know, his kids came and visited him all the time. And I guess because of his schedule, you know, he would work long, long hours. We all did. We all got very tired. But he liked being tired. He was happy when he was tired. And oftentimes we'd shoot, let's say, on a film for 12 hours, and we would go into the recording studio after that was finished, And about 9 o'clock in the evening, we'd start recording music that we were going to need in the film in a few days. Well, 10 or 11 o'clock, we would all be pretty tired. And somebody would fluff a line, and somebody else would start laughing. And we laughed and laughed and laughed, and we lost it. It was mostly Frank Oz and Jim Henson, myself, and Steve Whitmire. We were the least mature of the whole group. And you know, the work would have to stop for 20 minutes until we could pull ourselves together. And once when I was having lunch with Jim in Los Angeles, it was about 1985, and Dark Crystal had just come out. No, that's not right. That date isn't right. I think Labyrinth had just come out. It hadn't done too well. And so he was a little pensive about that and not as happy as normal. But he said, you know what I love more than anything else that we do? And I said, what? He said, when we laugh. I said, me too.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So what was more important to you guys, the craft or the story?
Yeah. Boy, you have great questions. Well, let me answer on Jim's behalf first. He was highly visual. You know, everything he did started with a visual image. And the script was something that came later for Jim, and his real strength was in the visuals. But he also had this ability to conceive of projects that had meaning. I mean, we did several things over the years. We did many, many things, but several things that were particularly meaningful. Like we did a Christmas special called Emma Daughter's Jug Band Christmas, and we did Fraggle Rock, the series. These kinds of projects, Fraggle was conceived by Jim calling a meeting and saying, I'd like to do a television program that stops war. And, of course, he nor anybody else had any illusions about whether war would be stopped by our television show. But it was about harmony between individuals, cultures, and species, and the environment. And that permeated every aspect of Fraggle Rock. And so it was a show that was really about something. I don't know if I answered your question. Did I answer your question?
Well, I think what you said was that the craft in making it visually perfect was really important, but the message may have even been more important.
I think it was more important to all of us. I think the message was more important to all of us. Ultimately. And then when Brian Henson took over the company, he had a great strength in screenplay and script. He was very good at working out the logic of a script and the arc of a story. So, you know, that sort of got added into the strong visual work that we were doing. But I don't know if I can answer which was more important. You know, I think it was all important, and I guess this goes back to another thing about Jim, which was that he liked a lot of density in the work. The visual image was usually dense. There were layers. Each time you watched something, you might see something new or hear something new, and so our work was very full. And I think that richness helps. Helps make it work both from a visual standpoint and from a, you know, story or a narrative standpoint.
I think that's one of the things which stands out to most people about the work that you guys did, which is that it played simultaneously on many levels, not just the adult and child level, but on the satirical level, the silly level, and every so often on the tremendously poignant level.
That was wonderful.
Bravo.
I loved that.
Oh, it was great.
Well, it was pretty good.
Well, it wasn't bad.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's true. And it was it was interesting because Jim, this goes back to Jim appreciating lots of different types of people. For example, on The Muppet Show, he had Jerry Jewell, who wrote with a tremendous amount of heart, became the head writer on second season and been with Jim for a long time. And Jerry wrote real meaningful character relationships. He also had Don Hinckley, who wrote, he was a comedy writer from the Carol Burnett Show. And so he was great at writing Dr. Bob, you know, Veterinarian's Hospital, all that kind of stuff. Don could just bang out, and he was brilliant at it. But he wouldn't particularly gravitate toward the kind of thing that Jerry Jewell wrote. And then there was Chris Langham, who was an English writer who was also a performer, is still a performer in England, and had this whole zany English twist on things. And then we had David O'Dell from Los Angeles, who was a very buttoned-down, kind of quiet, restrained guy. I'm not sure exactly what he wrote, but I know he wrote wonderful things. So, again, you know, you had a writing staff, each of whom was unique. And that, again, goes back to Jim being so interested in different types of people. And it produced very rich stuff. Oh, we also had Joe Bailey. Joe Bailey was a writer who had come to us from Sesame Street, long association with the Muppets. And, I mean, he came in with some political things. One moment that just stands out was he wrote the Sam Eagle bit, where Sam pronounces that he has a list of these people who are, you know, these people who are responsible for the depravity in the Muppet Show. And so, by the end of his tirade, his editorialization, he holds up a piece of paper and says, "I have a list." And, of course, it was a direct reference to Nixon. That was Joe Bailey. It wasn't something that Jerry Jewell or the others might have written, but it was Joe. It was just, oh, boy, what a privilege to work with all these different kinds of people.
But that resonates so well with today, because you could imagine just a few years ago, maybe Ashcroft holding up that list.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's eternal stuff. And I don't know, I just have to count it as an enormous privilege and just the good luck of fate that I got to be a part of all this, because there aren't many jobs where you are treated this way and where you're invited to contribute and where your work winds up meaning something, as well as being incredible fun.
Absolutely. And you were talking about uniqueness, and I think that's a good segue to probably your most famous character, which is Gonzo the Great. How do people in the workshop respond to this hook-nosed, bizarre sort of non-representational character? When did you know that Gonzo would work?
I didn't, and I don't understand him at all. I mean, it's the strangest thing. I guess to answer your question, the very first season of The Muppet Show, I was just beginning as a performer, and I felt completely out of place in show business. I mean, you know, Danny Kaye would walk in one door, I would go out the other. I just felt completely unentitled to see these people other than on a television screen or film screen. You know, all these guests that we had completely intimidated me. They were very nice and they were professional, but I was just convinced that I had no right to be there. And as a result, Gonzo, who was built originally as a sad-looking puppet, was quite a down personality in the first season. Jim was always asking me to make him more zany, and I couldn't because I felt so insecure and because he looked pretty sad. So at some point during the first season, I was asked to say no with great emphasis, or Gonzo was supposed to say no. And I kept doing it, and I kept holding back because I was so afraid. And Jim said, "No, just do it. Just let it go. Do it big." And Frank came over to me and said, "Your job is to be a fool. Just do it." And so I guess on about the eighth take, I went, "No!" And it got a big laugh from the crew. Now, the crew normally slept when I was working. This was a chance for them to catch up on their reading or a nap. And so the whole first season, I got one laugh out of the crew, which is a big accomplishment for me. And I went away between seasons, and I asked Jim if I could build a new Gonzo that had the capability of opening his eyes so that he could get excited. He said yes, and so I did that, came back the second season, and I got another laugh the second season. So now, after 2 years of doing this, I've got two laughs under my belt, and I'm on a roll. And eventually, the zaniness of Gonzo started coming out. And then the third phase of his development came many years later when we did, I guess it really came to fruition when we did the Muppet Christmas Carol in, I think it was 1992 that we shot it. And there, the soulful aspect of him came out. And the way this all happened was very much beneath the surface. Jerry Jewell and I, who was the head writer, were very dear friends. And without really talking to me about the character, he sort of drew from what I was going through in my personal life. and incorporated that into Gonzo. And I don't even know if he wanted to be conscious of it. You know, he didn't like to discuss that sort of thing because he felt it would ruin it. He didn't like too much consciousness in the work. But as a result, Gonzo sort of grew in terms of pitifulness, then to zaniness, and then to soulfulness, sort of in parallel with me. And as a result, it's very easy to ad-lib with him. But also, it's hard for me to explain to anybody who or what he is. I mean, I'm just delighted when people say they love him, but I don't exactly know why.
Well, but if you think about most people we know in our real lives, very few of us are one thing. We adopt multiple roles in different environments. We act different ways in different places or times. And we're different people sometimes, even in our different roles.
Well, you know, I used to say this to Jim early on in the Muppet Show. I said, Jim, I don't have a character of my own. I mean, I'm as a person, I don't know who Dave is. You know, because everybody that I'm with, I take on their characteristics. When I'm with you, he said, no, you don't. You're you. I know you. You're different than everybody else. I said, no. When I'm with you, I talk like you do. And then when I'm with my friend Paul, I talk like he does. And so I think that, you know, that certainly reinforces what you're saying. And it seems to, you know, now that I think about it after many years, I think that we all have a certain number of aspects to our personality, and being with friends gives us a context in which to take that particular aspect out for a walk.
Oh, absolutely. I tell people all the time that I have different friends and different jobs and different things, and I need each because each feeds a different part of my soul.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely true.
Now, you have an interesting backstory. You didn't actually have a formal background, in puppetry or in theater.
True.
What was your background, and how did you meet and get into this?
Well, I was trained as an industrial designer at the Art Center College of Design, which is now in Pasadena, and started a career in that field. I worked for Henry Dreyfuss Associates, whose clients were American Airlines, Polaroid Land Cameras, and a few others, but those were the ones I worked on. And then I moved to Hewlett-Packard and worked in an R&D lab as an industrial designer. And basically that means you design what products look like and how you interface with them, how you use them. And I liked it. I felt that it was a really interesting, fun way to make a living, but it wasn't a passion. You know, it wasn't life or death. And during the 3 years that I worked at HP, I started watching Sesame Street by accident. And I got hooked. I got curious about who the Muppets were, and I could see great depth, for example, in characters like Ernie and Bert. You know, there's two character types. Everything about them is consistent. The clothes they wear, the way they move, the way they talk, the way they think, all their choices. And I just wanted to know who these people were who made this clever stuff, because I could see the design in it. You know, I could see that it was all at once designed and spontaneous and lifelike, you know, and I just thought that was a great trick. And so as a result of that curiosity, I wound up meeting the Muppet people, and I met Jim eventually, and we ended up working together.
We take a step off our cobblestone path chat with Dave Goals to visit the Muppet Workshop, where the Muppet characters physically come to life. Oh, and it looks like we're going to be given a tour by an actual Muppet. Hi, what's your name?
Max Beaver.
Any relation to Justin Beaver?
No, definitely not. How can I help you? I'm kind of new here, you know, first day and all.
I understand that you're going to give us a tour of one of Jim Henson's first workshops.
Jim Henson's workshop? No, you don't want to go in there. You have no idea what goes on in there.
What goes on in there?
I have no idea.
Max, we're on deadline.
The deadline? No, I don't want to be a part of anything dead.
It just means I don't want to be late.
Well, you'll be the late Andrew Hiller if you go in there.
Come on, Max. Don't you want to find out how Muppets are made?
I'm too young for that. So I understand it has something to do with birds, bees, storks, and where applicable, tax deductions.
Come on, Max. It'll be fun. Let's go into the Muppet Workshop.
Well, okay, but I still don't like the Eyes!
What's wrong?
Eyes! The floor is covered in eyeballs!
Max, those are just ping pong balls.
What do you think my eyes are made of? Oh, look, that foam has a knife in it, and someone's been carving. This isn't a workshop. It's the set of Saw Part 19. This time it's puppets.
Max, calm down. It feels like felt.
Felt?
Yeah, it feels nice. Come here, touch it. It's soft.
Hey, that is felt. Some poor blue Muppet has been scalped. Oh, the humanity.
Max, don't you see? The felt, the ping pong balls, the foam? These are all things that the Muppet Workshop used to bring Muppets to life.
To life? To life?
L'chaim.
Don't start singing. We can't afford the rights.
Good catch. You know, Max, the creation of a Muppet character is a serious thing.
Yeah. One misstep, even the tiniest mistake, and they could create a monster.
Well, actually, a lot of the Muppets are monsters.
All right, that's it. I'm done. I can't take the stress. I'm coming apart at the seams.
Coming apart at the seams? Hey, you're in luck.
I am?
We're about to meet someone who can put you back together. In fact, I think she may have made you in the first place.
Mommy?
Close. It's Raleigh Crewson. Raleigh was the first intern to work as a puppet builder with Jim Henson. She's been involved in the birth of creatures great and small, including Wembley Fraggle and Abby Cadabby.
I know them.
And has worked with the Henson Workshop for over 37 years.
Mommy!
Max! Oh, I'll fix you up in a minute. I've got someone to talk to first.
All right, but be careful. I think he's wearing a microphone.
Hi, Raleigh. Welcome to Cobblestones. What really comes first? The story or the creature?
For Sesame Street, a lot of it is just story-based because we get a script and they'll have asked for, you know, a triangle that's a happy triangle or something. So you're going from that. Jim used to just come in with sketches and we'd just do stuff. He'd have an idea for a possible sketch, you know, so he'd come in with these little drawings and we'd build stuff. And he would eventually use it, or sometimes not, or sometimes it'd be put in a box for years and years, and then all of a sudden he'd go, wait a minute, you know, didn't we make such and such a long time ago, and we can use those. So they'd get pulled out, and they'd maybe be used for what he originally thought, or there'd be something totally different used for them.
And one of the things I remember when seeing some of Jim Henson's original sketches was how gestural they were. They weren't very specific, and they weren't diagrams. Was that because he wanted to give you guys the creative latitude and he trusted you, or was it something else?
I love the way he... It was interesting. When I first started, I interned, so I didn't get to really build anything, but the first puppets that I got to build were called Heaps and Stalks, and they basically were like little 5-6-line drawings on a page, and I had so much trouble doing them because I thought, oh, you know, what's in here? What's Jim trying to get me to do? And I don't understand. But as the years went on, that's the kind of sketch I preferred because, like you said, it did give me latitude to do kind of, I knew what he wanted finally, but he also gave me the creative, you know, freedom to do stuff myself. And I found it difficult to go from like Jim's sketches, which were these few lines, to like Michael Frith, who did everything painstakingly and you couldn't deviate at all. Jim's had a freedom to them, which I loved, you know, and I miss that.
How do you make a puppet? I mean, do you start with a sledgehammer, a blowtorch? Does it start with a sketch pad?
Yeah, a lot of times it starts with a sketch pad. I'm not as good sketching as I am doing three-dimensional things, so a lot of times I'll do a bunch of little foam models of things or clay models to get the shapes right. It starts there, and then it goes to foam, usually. A lot of our patterns are flat shapes that we then glue together, or it'll be a chunk of foam that you end up shaping with scissors and, you know, the bandsaw. We put it through a big bandsaw and cut out a shape and then take it and razor blade and scissor it down from there into what we want it to be.
The craft of puppet making requires a wide subset of skills. Good eyes, steady hands, knowledge of tools, patience, the ability to jury-rig and anticipate the needs of performers, and most importantly, a knack for dumpster diving.
when Muppets first started, I know that Jim used, like, he did use ping pong balls, you know, cut them in half or used them whole. We've used spoons, you know, spoons are great shapes for eyes. We've used grapes for noses, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. They come from anywhere that you can find them. We'll use plastic eggs. We used to use legs eggs. When legs, the nylons came in egg shapes, we used those all the time. We were really upset when those, then they didn't use them anymore. It's like, no, we need those shapes.
And in a world of automation and computers, the craftspeople at the Henson Workshop still do it the old-fashioned way.
Everything is hand-done. All the seams for the puppets are generally hand-stitched, especially those on the face, because we don't want them to show. Yeah, it's all hand-done. It's one of the few things left that are all hand-done. Sometimes we want to put them into the computer and have, you know, the Xerox machine spit them out. That would be nice.
Krusen built puppets for many Henson projects, including Sesame Street, The Muppet Show, and even The Dark Crystal. Through it all, she's earned the nickname The Queen of Cute.
There was one point where I said, oh, I just want to make something ugly. I don't want to be known for the Queen of Cute anymore. So we were building dragons. And so I tried to build the ugliest dragon, right? It was this big kind of fat lady, but she still kind of looked cute. So I've given up. If my puppets look cute, that's fine.
A common thought voiced by many who worked with Jim Henson sounds a bit like it came from the mafia. When working for Jim, it wasn't business. It was personal.
I babysat for his kids, and he'd have me over for dinner, and, you know, so he let me borrow his car. I was moving from one place to another place in Manhattan, and he let me borrow his car. So he was like second dad to me.
And that included familial teasing. The people behind the Muppets were almost as outrageous as the characters they portrayed. Krusen recalls that the long hours sometimes got just a little bit longer because of laughs, pranks, and practical jokes. Some of the Muppets were kind of tricksters. Was that true of the people behind the Muppets?
Oh, definitely. There was a couple of times when Jim, we were working on Muppets Take Manhattan, and he would be sitting around, you know, waiting for some shot to happen, and he'd have Kermit on his arm, and all of a sudden he'd call me over, and he'd say, my arm rod fell out, and I'd go, oh, okay, I'll put it back in, you know, I'd put more tape on it, pin it back in, hand him back the frog, and then, you know, go off and for a while. And, you know, that shot may have happened. And then he called me back again. And he said, my arm rod fell out. And I said, oh, geez, okay. Put it back in again. Went off, did something else. And then I'm kind of looking at the shot. And he's sitting. He's twisting the arm so that it's loosening the arm rod. And he's doing it on purpose so that he has to call me back over again. So finally, you know, I'm watching him, and he looks around at me, and he realizes that I saw him doing it, and he blushed, and he laughed. It's like, okay, gotcha.
But some stories that are funny today were kind of embarrassing when they happened.
We had a bottle of liquid smoke, and I had to take that with me, and I had it. It was in the old shop, and there was a spray booth that it vented onto 67th Street, and the bottle spilled, and I had it in the spray booth, but it went out the vent and it smoked out the vent, and I'm trying to get ready to go, and I was like, oh no, and I like quickly bottled it back up again, and I'm packing up to get ready, and the elevator opens. It's Saturday. The elevator opens, and these three firemen come in with their axes and everything. I'm going, what? What? We saw smoke. Somebody reported smoke. I went, I said, no, it was me. I'm sorry. It was a bottle of liquid smoke. It went out the vent.
Speaking of smoke effects, the Muppets are almost as well known for their songs as they are for their gags. Whether it was Dr. Teeth and Animal blasting out a rock anthem, a folksy lament, or an instrumental underscore, music always played a role. And while strolling with us on cobblestones, Dave Goles says that some songs, like Gonzo's I'm Going Back There Someday from the Muppet Movie, became special, even beyond the scope of film and tape.
Familiar, vaguely.
Familiar. Oh, yeah. That, well, you know, that song wasn't even written into the movie. It was something that when Paul Williams wrote the songs, he felt a kinship with Gonzo. I think he felt, well, he's always described Gonzo as a flightless bird. And somehow Paul felt related to that. And just for his own enjoyment, he wrote that song and submitted it to Jim. And Jim loved it so much that he had a scene written so that the song could be included. And this, you know, it's become one of my favorites, of course. And I've sung it to my kids at bedtime when they were little for, you know, hundreds of times. And when Jim died, we did a medley of songs at his memorial in the Cathedral of St. John of the Divine in New York. And that was one of the songs we did. I sang that song. And more recently, there's been another occurrence of that song when Paul Williams did a surround sound super high fidelity DVD that is sort of like an audio and video DVD with natural acoustics, produced by a company called AIX Records. And this is only available on their website, by the way. But we did a duet of that song together, Gonzo and Paul. And it was just lovely. It was so great to be back with Paul and to do that together.
I was wondering, on that level, is delivering a song with the Henson or Muppet sensibility really hard or just really joyful?
You know, it's funny. You ask about singing. I don't actually have a singing voice of my own. If somebody said, go in and sing a song, I would have no idea what to do. Because, I first of all, I don't have a good voice. And second, I can't have no control over it. So singing in character is really the only way I can do it. And I've been able to sing in all the characters that I perform, which is quite a few, and manage to get by without being completely fired and thrown out. But again, it's a sort of a Walter Mitty exercise for me that I've been privileged to be in many, many recording studios all over the world. You know, the famous ones, the big ones, as a complete imposter. And I can manage to hold on well enough to be there. And I really enjoy it. You know, it's so much fun singing with a band or tracks and being part of the creation of music. It's something I just have no talent for normally. So, you know, singing in those characters is the only way that I get to do it.
Is there a story, an anecdote, that sort of crystallizes who and what Jim Henson was?
In my early years, probably, I started in 1973, and so this might have been 1973, 74. It was Jim's birthday, and we were all aware that nobody could keep up with Jim. He looked so skinny and frail, but he was an Iron Man. And we were always more tired than he was. So for his birthday, I went down to 14th Street to a skin diving shop in New York, and I rented a weight belt for him. They had about 30 pounds of weight, and I gave it to him as a present, and, you know, with a card that said something like, this is to try to equalize us so that we can keep up with you. And he got a big laugh out of it, and he put it on and modeled it. And he said, that's very nice. And I said, now, it's actually rented, Jim, but if you promise to wear it, I'll go down and buy it for you. And he had another laugh, and in the end, I took it back, and we couldn't keep up with him. Another one was he discovered the arts and crafts movement in England, the mid-19th century movement that reintroduced arts and sort of in the face of an increasingly industrialized world. And he would go down to Liberty's, the store on Regent Street in London, and buy these beautiful patterned shirts. They were not paisley, but they were sort of flowered patterns that were based on designs from that period. And he would buy ties. And so he had ties that had a different pattern than the shirt. And they were all beautiful and tasteful and very ornate. But at one time for his birthday, again, we were in England doing the Muppet Show, I got a pair of just regular old-fashioned tennis shoes. These are the canvas high tops, you know, the old-fashioned canvas high tops. Anyway, I got an old-fashioned pair of canvas high tops for him, and I went and bought some Liberty fabric that was the same type of stuff as his shirts, and I cemented it on over the canvas. I did a really immaculate job so that he now had Liberty print tennis shoes. And then the rest of the shop produced a wild outfit that was a sort of a caricature of what he was wearing. And again, we gave it to him, and he put it on, and he modeled it and swanned around the shop and really, had a great deal of fun sort of sending himself up. And that, again, was Jim. You know, he had the ability to laugh with everybody and at himself, and he just couldn't have been a better boss.
You know, that's really pretty incredible to hear. You know, so many people I meet are full of grumpitude, professionally angry people who are always looking at the smallest detail in order to get themselves to be unhappy. It must have been just exceptional working with someone like him.
I can't tell you what an extraordinary privilege it is to have been there and to get to talk about it. And, one of my hopes is that people out there will be inspired to create work lives like this themselves, people who own companies will, would be wonderful if there were more people who ran companies the way Jim did. I mean, he was a marvelous creator, he was more than just a dreamer, though. He could find a way to make a business out of it, which was hugely important, because what we did was very complicated and expensive, and so he built this, over the years, he built this incredible production entity that included everything he needed. It wasn't just performers and puppet makers and writers, but it was a licensing department that knew exactly what the Muppets were about. Wonderful people there, wonderful people in publishing. So he had this little group of, it got fairly big during a certain period. But he built this group that could just really do the Muppets. Everybody knew about it. The janitor knew about it. They were all part of it.
And that's the thing you don't find very often, except for in the biggest of successes, which is the incredible artist who also is a great businessman, who can bridge both those worlds.
Yeah, that's very hard to do. Very hard to do. So, a lot of people can create brilliant things, but, most of us who can do that stop there. But he found a way to bring it to the people. Really, that was business for him was just a way of transporting his work to the audience. And he saw it. This is another thing I should say about Jim, and that was that I learned my business ethic from him. And he never pontificated. He never said a word about his approach to business. He just showed by example. But I could see that he valued himself, and he probably drove a hard bargain. But he always delivered more than he promised. And that simple way of working, I think, benefited everybody around him. And, of course, it ultimately benefited him, too.
That's what I was trained to. I was trained whenever you agree to do something, whether it's for money or not, you do your best. And if you can't do it, you don't say you're going to do it at all.
Yeah, exactly. And there are business people around who see as an I win, you lose proposition. If I can somehow gain the advantage and beat you in a deal, then I've won. And Jim never saw it that way. He believed that both parties needed to profit, and he wanted this deal to be good for you, not just him.
That's very cool.
Yeah, oh boy, I'm telling you, it was a rare way of thinking.
That's also a pretty brilliant branding concept. I mean, they got to the point where absolutely everyone knew their name, but no one knew their face.
Oh, yeah. The other aspect of the career that relates to what you were talking about is just that it's anonymous. I mean, there's certainly there's a core of fans who know who we all are and who would recognize us on the street, but it almost never happens. And so as a result, we have normal lives.
That's actually brilliant.
It's wonderful. We don't have to think about being a brand.
I'll tell you a very quick story just out of silliness. I was doing a story on ghost tours around the Washington, Baltimore area. And someone saw me approaching with my recorder and my mic. And they said, oh, we know who you are. And I said, yeah. They said, yeah, you're the tour guide. And I said, no, I'm here to do a report for NPR. And all of a sudden, they all started taking out their cameras and snapping pictures. And I just fell over laughing because it was the most ridiculous thing to me. You know, these people are taking photos and like 2 weeks later, they're going to develop their film or they'll download their film, I guess, nowadays. And they're going to look at it and say, who the heck is this guy? Why were we interested in having this picture?
It's really funny, isn't it?
It is.
We went to England and we shot the first season of The Muppet Show, and it wasn't on the air at that point. And I used to go every Saturday morning to this little local bakery, and I got to know the ladies who worked there. You know, I'd order toast and coffee, and I'd go sit down and read the paper. And it was my Saturday morning ritual. And these ladies were very matronly and very motherly toward me, and they sort of adopted me as their American friend who was over working on something or other. So the next year I came back, and by that time the show had come on the air in England, and it was a huge hit. It was just a monster hit. And as soon as I walked in the door the first time, the ladies whispered to each other and pointed to me, and they whispered to some new employees that I didn't know. And all of a sudden, I was under scrutiny. And I went, and then they were giggling and blushing. These were women who, you know, I was 27, and they were 60 or 55. And, I felt a little scrutinized, and I got my toast and coffee, and I went and sat down and was reading it. And any time I looked up, I could see people pointing to me. Customers would come in, and they'd say, "That's him over there. He's the one." And, you know, it was just so bizarre. It was so bizarre. And then when I left, they asked me for my autograph. And, of course, that was the very first autograph. And the idea of signing your name, as I'm sure you can, you know, attest to, and then somebody keeps it, it's just bizarre. It's just the weirdest thing, you know. It has no, it just never happens to a normal person. So, that was a transition that I remember. It was really kind of funny. But the beautiful thing about it is that we more or less have control over it. You know, nobody that I deal with in my everyday life knows what I do for a living. You know, except friends and, you know, our kids' friends.
Huh, that's interesting.
You know, I go to the hardware store and I see Phil, and Phil is always knows what to recommend, and I go ask him for his advice. And only recently did I finally tell him what I do for a living, and I've known him for 15 years.
Is it like a Clark Kent thing? You know, you go over to the hardware stores and you're like, I need 30 pounds of blue foam. And he just...
Yeah, well, it's not that I order something weird. It's just that he helps me, and we have he knows me as a customer, and I know him as the guy who can help me. And I've talked about Phil to people like you for years and years and years, 15 years. And so about a month and a half ago, I was in there, and I said, you know, Phil, I'm always telling stories about you. And he said, what? And I explained this all to him, and he was just blown away. But the thing is, when people know what I do for a living, they treat me different. And that's nice, and I mean, it's usually nice, but not always good. I mean, something happened years ago. We wanted to take some friends to a special restaurant in the wine country in California, a very famous place where it's hard to get a table. And I called up to try to get a table, and they didn't have anything. I said, sorry, I can't help you. And just as an experiment, I called our office and asked them to call and get a table for me. Bang. 7:30, center of the house.
I should try that since no one knows who you guys are.
Exactly.
They might actually think, you know, I could be Beaker.
It might work. I don't know. It might work. But in any case, it worked that time, and we did it because our friends wanted to, they really wanted to eat at that restaurant. And so after that, I just said, I'm never going back to this restaurant. I don't like restaurants that you know, have no table for a normal person.
I agree.
You know?
Yeah. So you have been overly kind, and
oh, it's fun. You know what? It's just fun. It's fun. I was very privileged to work with Jim, and I love to talk about it.
Just thank you. This has been a great pleasure for me.
Well, I got to tell you, you ask incredibly perceptive questions.
Well, thank you.
You are really good at this, and it was just one of the best interviews I've ever had. You know, the questions you were asking remind me of what Terry Gross does.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a nice compliment.
I think she's the premier interviewer that I've ever heard. I mean, she's just so good because she asks very deep, perceptive questions and then follows up. And it's really, really good.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for joining us as we walk down the cobblestone path. This journey began for me in 2008. It didn't begin easily. The first stone was a story that I had been working on for WAMU's Metro Connection that very suddenly failed to happen. As I nervously called my producer, David First, to apologize, I spied a poster marking the Fantastic World of Jim Henson exhibit at the Smithsonian Institution. With David's go-ahead, I immediately shifted gears and changed stories. Now, you wouldn't think that working on a Muppet story would inspire fear, but it does. These are people who made it, and whose work has entered our cultural mythology. But more importantly, these were people whose characters were a part of my childhood. I created my vision of Jim Henson watching Sesame Street and singing C is for Cookie, or laughing with the Muppet Show. Could I bear the disillusionment if these people turned out to be jerks or divas? What would happen to my childhood heart? Luckily, each person involved with the Muppets that I've met has turned out to be who I imagined. Maybe they hid the rats. Sorry, Rizzo. The empathy, humor, and intelligence of Henson's work shines in the stories and the people Jim Henson chose. Hopefully, I've been able to express that within these two cobblestone episodes. A quick story, because we're running out of time. I interviewed Jane Henson, Jim's widow, at the Smithsonian International Gallery. She was sweet, but a little cautious. When we finished speaking, she left, and I began interviewing one of the docents. A few moments later, there was this timid knock on the door. We paused, and Jane peeked her head in, and she asked, "My daughter's here. Would you mind speaking with her, too?" My heart just melted. It was then I knew that my childhood heart would remain intact. This cobblestone path wends its way from Washington, D.C. through Manhattan on its way to Los Angeles before culminating at Dave Gohl's home in Northern California. It couldn't have been done without the help of many. Our thanks go out to Arthur Novell, Bonnie Erickson, Ellen Lewis, David First, with production assistance from Jonathan Cherry, Toby Schreiner, Alicia Hiller-Mamadov, Eric Brooks, and of course a special thank you to Dave Gohls, Jim Lewis, Fran Brill, and Roly Crewson, who lent their talent, as well as their time. Thank you for helping us place one more stone along the path. For Cobblestones, I'm Andrew Hiller.